skim milk masquerades as cream. Externals don't portray insides. Jekylls may be masking hides. Hear ye, hear ye. We went to Vespers last night and heard about differences. And I think that's another thought I want us to keep in mind while we talk. I'm Molly Raymond, and I actually didn't expect to be here sitting in his chair talking to people, but here I am. There have been some folks asking me about the work I do in prison, and I'm not an expert. I'm just a person that happened by circumstances to become acquainted with a group of people that are really all of our little known sisters. We just don't know the people in prison, and I happen to be privileged to get acquainted with quite a few of them. And so my main purpose here is just to share with you what 7 years of associating with the people, the women in the Shakopee prison. That's the state prison in Minnesota for women. All felons who are female are sent to that prison. And what we do really is we just try to be bridges, I guess, between, from the inside to the outside and from the outside to the inside. It's been said that the walls of prison were not really made to keep the inmates inside, but they've been put there to keep the public, the people outside, from getting in. Because our society seems to say that when someone has offended us to the point of breaking one of our laws and being convicted, that they should, they should somehow become invisible. We just don't really want them. And so we'll put them behind walls so we don't see them. And so they are our little known sisters. And I got that phrase from Harriet. She says she went to a very interesting group one time where she learned about little known religions. And I thought of that. There, every person in a sense is a religion, and we really don't know much about what's going on in the world, and things are not what they seem to us until we get inside and try to see some of the scary unknown, okay? And crime and prison and inmates, convicts, and all this are very, very scary topics, and they don't take on any. We just can't even think about these people as our sisters unless we know them. And so what we do is go down for 2 hours every Wednesday evening. And there's a varying population in Shakopee Prison. All over the country, there are not as many women incarcerated as there are men. So it's usually about 50, between 30 and 50 women. And they are in Shakopee. And we meet with as many of them as want to come and meet with us. We got permission to have 2 hours every Wednesday where we could have a discussion group where the staff would not be present. Unfortunately, in any institution, even in school with kids and teachers, there gets to be kind of a Cold War, kind of a we-they aspect, and nobody feels real free to talk what they want unless the teacher's out of the room, or something. So the staff and the inmates are just not real comfortable with each other, even though the one is supposed to be helping me, the other. But we ask for permission to meet with the women, with the staff not present, so they could feel free to talk about anything they wanted. And it started with a young man I met when I was in school. I'm kind of a late starter. I didn't start school till my youngest daughter was in junior high school, and I started as a freshman. And so my friends were all about the same age as my kids, some of them in college. So I met Jim while I was in school. And he wanted me to come and help him because he had started this group in Shakopee where he was teaching the Indian inmates their Chippewa language. Now, the Indians in our country, many of them have lost their pride in their heritage, and they don't even know their own religion, they don't know their own religions very well either. But they have lost their language, they've lost their pride, you notice so much for example, St. Olaf College, they really know Chrisman, they know the Norwegian heritage, and everybody's got Norwegian sweaters, and it's really a good thing for the people to know their heritage, and the Indians many of them have lost this. So Jim was teaching them Chippewa language if they wanted to learn it. And after the prison population changed a bit and some of the other people that weren't Indian wanted to come in on it, he suddenly had a very popular session going. And they had kind of finished their unit on the Indian language, and he says, well, what do you want to do now? And they said, well, why don't we just keep this? This is a great group as just discussion. And so they did that. And so then everybody, all races and nationalities began coming in there to the two-hour session. He says, well, what do you want to talk about? So they said, well, we'd like to talk about prison reform. And so he says, okay. So it's been kind of prison reform-ish ever since, and it might be anything. We bring anybody down to our discussions who wants to come down and who has something to share with the women on the inside. This lets the women see who's out there. Now, there are all kinds of resources in the community that many of them didn't know existed. And sometimes it's maybe a neighbor of mine who likes to do macrame, and she'll come down and do macrame. Maybe it's a woman gynecologist who can talk to the women about their own bodies and let them know what kinds of things they should expect when they get a doctor's examination, some kind of health care. Maybe it's somebody from one of the social agencies that can tell them where they can get help on the outside if they got a drug problem or an alcohol problem. It might be a school person. Sometimes we bring a band down and we just have music. And one time my daughter came down with her guitar and she played guitar. So that's kind of bringing the outside in. But the other half of it is that the women in prison become our teachers, and we get to know them. And so the outside is learning from the inside, and they are not only learning what the resources are, but we are learning about what's going on under the name of justice in our society. And we learn not only to find out, there's a whole lot we need to investigate about the whole thing of crime and justice. We also learn to know some people. And one area of our lives has been improved because we're not scared anymore of convicts. And we recognize them as our sisters, and we see these people as people. So the main reason that I guess my most important thing I can do for you for this session is to just share with you my acquaintances in prison and tell you about some of the women and who they are, so that you can see not a convict. And I don't know what you see when you hear that word, but most of us see something that is not really very real. There are two points I want to make, and I guess I'll make them right away, even though they're maybe not related, but just before I get into introducing you to some of the people I know, I just want to say one word about health, a healthy community. We had some talks by Fritz Norstedt last week, and you folks, I guess, missed most of you weren't here last time when you heard him talking about health and health care. But I would say a word about a healthy community. And one of the ways in which this came to me was that people keep asking me, why do you do this? You know, I don't have anybody in prison. And, I'm not that terribly much of a do-gooder, I don't think. And so I really, when somebody says, why do you do this? I had kind of a time to answer. I had to ask myself, well, why do I? And I think one of the reasons is that it has, through the years, become impressed on me that I want to live in a healthy community. And if there's crime and revenge and violence and poverty and sickness and ignorance of ourselves, then I can't think that I'm living in a healthy community. And some people say this society is sick. Okay, what do we mean by society is sick or we're in an unhealthy community? I think you can look at a family and you can say that family is healthy where all of the members are being served. You know, they have several kids in the family. One of them maybe is a mischief maker. One of them is a real incorrigible. One of them is very talented. One of them maybe is a cripple. Well, a healthy family is someone that can have all these people together at the table and all of them understand that we love each other. And we've got the resources to take care of whatever is the matter with the members of our family. An unhealthy family to me, or an unhealthy community, would be one in which the only people who were had the right to live there were those who were proper and capable and talented. The ones who deviated from the norm were shoved out and left to lie somewhere. You know, if we've got a community where we've got to kick out everybody who we don't think is right, then I don't think our community is very healthy. And it kind of came to me that I live in Minneapolis, and if I'm going to have pride in the place I live, I really have to feel good about the community, that it's that kind of caring, healthy community that takes care of all its members. And if there's a bunch of us that are being left out, then my community isn't very healthy. So that's the one point. One of the reasons that I think I work in the prison. The other point I want to make is something I got from a book a little pamphlet, really, by a man named Richard Korn. I went to one of his seminars at the University of Minnesota, and he's a criminal justice professor. And he said, think about rules and think about criminals. What is a criminal? Well, a criminal is someone we really arbitrarily label as a criminal. And the reason they get labeled that way is that they've broken a law. So he says you got to think about the law. And he says rules are made to be broken. He says you don't believe that? He says we all consider ourselves to be law-abiding citizens. But really, when you think about it, really, what we really don't know what we mean when we say that, because we make these laws and then we proceed to try and break them. He says prestige in this country, in most any country, is acquired by people and is evidenced by how many rules they can break. For example, you've got a law that you got to go a certain 30 miles an hour on the street. But the mayor of the town has an important thing to do, and he drives down in his limousine and breaking all the speed rules and all the semaphores turn green for him because he's an important person. Okay, and then there's a long line of people for a lecture or something, and they're all waiting in line to buy their ticket. And then seven people come in, and one is a very important person. You can tell by the way he walks, and he goes right up the head of the line and goes in front of all of us. He's a very important person. He has enough prestige in our society to break the rules. He doesn't have to wait in line. Okay? That's kind of, we get privileged by getting successful. And we can know how much success we have by how many rules we can break. And the people who don't have any power at all can't break any rules. They really got to march right with the crowd, and they have to toe the line. And, you know, you don't have much power when you can't break any rules. So this is what Dr. Korn made kind of plain to me, that the rules are more or less arbitrary. They're set for for the kind of the majority, or at least the ruling class in any society, and everybody else has to mind them, but not us, because we're the privileged few. And so power and prestige go together, and if you've got power to break rules, then you're pretty good. All right, where someone is absolutely impotent, either it's real or it's just imagined, but that one or that whole group has no power. They don't feel that they have any power to make any rules in this society. Yet the same thing operates. The more rules you can break, the more prestige you have. You've got kind of a ghetto culture where it's kind of prestigious if you were able to get away with breaking all these rules that you didn't make and you don't get caught. And so the little kids in a lot of our cities grow up looking up to their big brothers and sisters that were able to strip a Cadillac in 15 minutes and not get caught. And they're doing the same thing, really the same thing as our kids in high school that have got the privilege of walking down the hall in the high school without a pass because they're the president of the row club or something. You know, it's not that much different. So Dr. Korn made that kind of plain to me, and that's one of the frame of references I now have that was given to me to look at crime and criminals. Now, that's all the talking I'm going to do about crime and criminals, because it's such a big subject and I'm not an expert and I don't really know all that much about it, even though, you know, just experience with the people. But I'd like to recommend this book to you. This is called The Crime of Punishment, and it's by Carl Menninger, and he's a psychiatrist who has written about crime. I can give you a couple little samples. You're never supposed to recommend a book unless you kind of tease the audience into reading more, and you only read a little bit, so they don't know the whole plot, so they have to go get it. So I want to read you just a wee little bit of this. And if I'm boring anybody, please raise your hand and say I'm bored, okay? This is just the beginning out of chapter one. Few words in our language arrest our attention, as do crime, violence, revenge, injustice. We abhor crime. We adore justice. We boast that we live by the rule of law. Violence and vengefulness we repudiate as unworthy of our civilization, and we assume this sentiment to be unanimous among all human beings. Yet crime continues to be a national disgrace and worldwide problem. It is threatening, alarming, wasteful, expensive, abundant, and apparently increasing. It seems to increase faster than the growth of our population, faster than the spread of civilization. Included among the crimes that make up the total are those which we commit, we non-criminals. These are not in the tabulations, they're not listed in the statistics, and are not described in the President's Crime Commission studies. But our crimes help to make the recorded crimes possible and even necessary. And the worst of it is we don't even know we're guilty. Perhaps our worst crime is our ignorance about crime. That's one little part. And then he talks about the idea of imprisonment, and I work with these women in prison. And prison is, don't let anybody try to tell you that prison is for rehabilitation or some dumb thing, you know, it isn't. It's for punishment. It really is for punishment. And he says imprisonment in this section. The idea of punishment as the law interprets it seems to be that inasmuch as a man has offended society, society must officially offend him. It must deliver him a tit for the tat that he committed. The tit must not be impulsive retaliation, not mob action. It must be done dispassionately, by agency, by stipulation, and by statute. It must be something that will make the offender sorry, or sorrier, for what he did and resolve to do it no more. Let no one deceive himself about the intention of the prison to be a terrible place. And then he's talking in this section about the diagnostic center. We have this image of prisoners, of criminals, as being somehow sick. And so we got to treat them. And so they are talked about as if they were medical patients. And they go to a diagnostic center to see what they're sick. Really what we should turn around and, you know, look at ourselves and say, what's the matter with us that we have this person in our society behaving this way? But we don't. We say he's sick. And or that's a different image than we used to have. We used to call him a sinner. And the word penitentiary comes from that old idea that a criminal was a sinner. And he had to go to a place where he'd become penitent and think about his crimes, you know. And so that was supposed to be a humane way, because they used to put him in the street on stocks because he was a criminal. He had to be punished by sticking his feet through these things or whipping or all kinds of things. And it was the Quakers that decided that that wasn't very humane. We better put him in a place where he can think about his sins, and we got prisons out of that. Long time before that, criminals used to be thought of as possessed of the devil, and things had to be exorcised out of them. But now we don't think, we're enlightened, and we think of them as sick. So we go to a diagnostic center, and this is a prisoner. When he was 18, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for statutory rape. He violated his parole last year and was taken back to prison. He was combative, and hence was transferred to another, more secure prison. Here he was so explosive, so violent, so given to attacks of rage and self-injury that he was transferred again, this time to a state hospital. But the doctors and nurses in the state hospital, accustomed to maniacs and madmen, were afraid of him. So he was returned to prison for custody. However, the prison people still did not want him, and he was sent to the diagnostic center to be referred. Where? I can't control myself, he admitted, but still I want to be turned loose. Yet I don't dare go back in the street. I'll kill or get killed, but I can't stand it in here either. My God, this is awful. Can you do something? I have half killed myself a dozen times. I will succeed one of these days, me or one of you. You better keep me locked up, but it ain't doing me any good. If this man were moaning with pain from a mangled hand, any of us would have pity on him because we could see blood and tendon. But because his pain is internal and because he has injured others, he gets little pity. He needs treatment. He begs for it. But where shall we treat him? We just don't know. Thus, hidden from public gaze, with citizens enjoying the pleasant sense of security and thinking they are being protected from the lawless by modern civilized methods, the terrible, dreadful prison regime grinds on an endless contest between caged animals. I think I won't read any more, but that's kind of Carl Menninger, and you can really get an insight to what it is, the overall picture of prisons. But I'm just going to talk about a little picture, the size of me and my friends that drive 30 miles down to Shakopee. That's kind of significant too, because it's 30 miles. Anybody wants to go to school, anybody wants to get vocational training, anybody wants to go see a doctor, they're 30 miles away. And any of us, you know, I like to have some friends come down there with me, because we do need a lot of help. And there's that 30 miles that the volunteer has to drive. So it's real too bad that we put our prisons way off there and not right around us where we can surround these people with some of our resources. That's just beside the point. I want to tell you about some of our little known sisters. And they're all, I'm not a bleeding heart, and I'm not saying that these poor people never did anything bad. They did. They're lawbreakers. But it's a strange thing. We're all sinners too, you know. But we don't go around beating our breasts. And sometimes we sort of make a little excuse for ourselves and we say, yeah, we're all sinners, but I'm really not as big a sinner as those other people. And the prisoners do this too. They know they're convicted and they did something. They wrote a bad check. They helped in an armed robbery. They maybe killed their husband. Or, you know, they might have done any of the felonious things. But still, everybody himself, in order to remain sane, has to have some kind of extenuating circumstances around himself. So while they know their crime and they know they went there, they say, but there's a few excuses for me, because really it wasn't like with those others. There isn't one in there that feels that she's as guilty as everybody thinks she is. And so they're all guilty, but they kind of, in their own, they have to make up some kind of a feeling that so that they feel more relatively innocent in order not to. Those that can't do that are doing very hard time, is what they speak of as being having a hard time in prison. And they just can't take it. They begin, you know, banging their head against the wall, and they're forever in trouble, and they're having to be locked in solitary and everything because they can't find this way to feel relatively good about themselves, even in prison. But of course, the ones who come to our group are generally not doing hard time. They're still outgoing enough to come and visit with us, and they're not hurting quite as much as those women who don't come to our group and stay up in their rooms. The Shakopee prison doesn't have any bars on it. It looks like a young girls, a parochial school maybe, or a small college. There's grass and driveways and four or five like campus buildings. And so the imprisonment in Shakopee is psychological and not with physical bars, although they do lock the doors. And when you go down there to visit somebody, you're made aware of all the times this custody person has to unlock and lock a door. But they're not really locked in that sense. First, I want to tell you about Clara. She was one of the first women that I met when I went to Shakopee. Clara was 56 years old, and she was in prison for writing bad checks. And I don't always know what they're there for, but if they offer to tell me, well, then I know. But I don't say, what are you here for? You know, I don't have that privilege. If I were in there myself, I would. But Clara had five children, and she is kind of a dependent sort of person. You know, she really needs some help with her five kids, and her husband died. And she was really kind of at a loss. But she wasn't a strong woman, able to handle the situation without her husband. But she had a brother, and so her brother kind of helped her and gave her mostly moral support, I think, because, you know, she worked and she could earn money all right, but her brother kind of helped her along. Then right away, within that same year, her brother died, and she didn't have anybody to rely on. She went out to work every day, and she worked, but she began relieving her anxiety with alcohol, and she always kept the house clean. Man, I never saw such a housekeeper as Clara was. After she got out of prison, I went and visited her in her apartment. It was neat as a pin. And she always was neat and clean herself. And her hair was always combed. She was clean. So she kept her house up. She kept her kids well fed. But her extra money, if she had any, would go for a bottle of booze. And then she'd drink alone at night. And she got really hooked on alcohol to where her salary didn't cover her booze. And so she began writing checks. And this just went from bad to worse, you know. And after a while, she couldn't control all this. She'd have blackout periods, and then she'd be picked up and thrown in the detoxification center. And then she was afraid when that happened that they'd find out about all these checks she'd written. And so she just went from anxiety to anxiety. And finally, of course, the inevitable happened. She was picked up for writing bad checks, and she was in prison. And Clara was there for a long time. She had been a waitress, but she kept, whenever she got out, she kept going and getting the booze again. She just couldn't help it. And she was a pleasant person. When she finally did get released, she'd done her whole time. She had $100. And by this time, her daughter's married, and the husband of her daughter, her son-in-law, had just lost his job. So they couldn't pay the rent that month, so they said, Ma, come and live with us, and you can pay rent to us, and then you got a place to live. So she went, and she lived with them, and she paid the $100 to them for rent, but soon didn't work out too well because her daughter was very uptight about her drinking, and so then Clara went out and had just a little beer, you know, and wow, daughter explodes and kicks her out and says, no way, are you going to stay here? So she's out on the street and didn't have a dime, and went to the Minneapolis Relief Office to get some relief. And I went through this process with her of trying to get $3 for food and a place to live and 6 dimes to find a job and travel the bus back and forth to find a place to live. And boy, that really taught me a lot about how hard it is for a person to start from below zero in the city and work with all these bureaucracies and get yourself a job and a place to live. Miserable. But that was Clara, and I used to like her. She always made coffee for our group. Whenever we came down, she says, I've got the coffee ready, and she'd have some cookies, and she'd serve them. Rachel was another girl. Now, Rachel was about 30. She must have been 6 feet tall, and she was blonde, and one eye was crossed, bright blue eyes, but one was crossed, and she was a very striking, appearing woman. And could she sing? She had the most glorious voice. In the little variety show we had, Rachel, really, she could be a performer anywhere if she just had got steered in that direction. But I don't know what troubled Rachel. She had a whole lot of problems, and she just had so much hostility in her against everybody in the whole world that she was forever in trouble and forever getting back in prison. And she was back there 3 or 4 times in the 7 years that I've been there. And, I don't know if she'll ever... Someday she may find out how to use her marvelous gift of singing and make it, but I just am not sure about that. I guess Rachel must be a person that hurts an awful lot. You know, Fritz told us that when we're hostile, it's an evidence of hurt. And I read in another book a little thing about that. I think it's about this hostility. Yeah. Many people think, I can't read without my glasses. I've just got glasses this last 6 months. I haven't learned how to put them on. Many people think they are acting the way they feel when they tell someone off. Rachel was real good at telling people off. Someone is critical of me and I answer by calling him an SOB. My feeling is not that he's an SOB. My feeling is that he's hurt me. You have hurt my feelings and now I want to hurt your feelings. Launching an attack, this is a verbal attack, but, you know, any attack, covers up my feeling of being hurt with an appearance of strength. I get angry when I think someone has hurt me in a way I'm helpless to do anything about. And I just suspect that Rachel just really hurt. Because, for one thing, she was Jewish, and she was somehow or other not comfortable with her Jewishness. Maybe because she was so tall and blonde and didn't really look Jewish, I don't know, but that was Rachel. These are real brief sketches of these women. You know, if you get to know them, there's an awful lot more to each of them than I'm just giving you a brief picture. I want to tell you about Candy. Candy's a young girl the same age as my own daughter. Candy is a mulatto. Her father was black, her mother was white. She grew up in the St. Paul housing project. And Candy's told me she... about guns. You know, we've had a lot of talk about guns and firing and everything in the city and the newspapers. And Candy says, boy, she says, I wouldn't have felt comfortable at night if I didn't hear gunshots. It's so normal. Now, she's exaggerating a little bit. But in other words, part of the normal part of her growing up environment was shooting. Somebody, you know, gunshot, they'd hear them at night. And she knew she was home then. She'd sleep somewhere where she didn't hear something going off in the night, and she would wonder where she was. That's one. But Candy's a beautiful girl. She looks like a model. She's a really good figure. She's nice, pretty hair, and a beautiful golden complexion that many mulattoes have. And she has a little girl named Tanya, who's 4, and a little baby. Candy is full, she is intelligent, she is full of vim and vigor, and she's just, you're sitting with Candy and the room zings. She's just got a whole lot of energy. And she also has a lot of rage. And in her age group, you know, she's gotten to the notion of black power. And she's, you know, all for this. Her mother is white, so this gives her a real problem. But one of the things that Candy's afraid of, she's in prison for murder. She killed her boyfriend, and she, of course, didn't mean to. Nobody, very few people mean to. And she told me, she says, that first night, she says, you don't need a long sentence. Because she says, the first night in prison, you know it all. And there's nothing can bring him back, and you know it. And she says, boy, you have experienced all the punishment you're ever going to get that first night in prison. And she said this with such feeling, and she doesn't often talk in this kind of serious way. Mostly she's pretty flip. And so I have to believe that that's the way it is with her. But Candy is most afraid of being institutionalized. What that means is they kind of break your spirit, and she's afraid of that. She wants to remain herself, even though she knows she has to do time. Well, one of the ways that she can remain herself is by... confronting and flouting the rules of the prison. So they say, and also she's afraid, you know, it's a homosexual society in prison. You know, they're all women in one prison and all men in another prison. And so your view of humanity gets kind of distorted because, you know, if you're used to a heterosexual society with men and women in it, and you have just women, you start making them the whole world. And so Candy is afraid. She doesn't want to become a homosexual. She wants to remain as she is. And so one of the ways she's combating is the rules is by whenever she gets a chance. And how she does it, I don't know, but she goes out and she has a good time with her boyfriend. And of course, so she's gotten pregnant. And even while she's serving time, when she wasn't even supposed to be, you know, in any situation where she could even have relations with her boyfriend. So this is terrible. I mean, this is the worst thing she could do, to put the prison on the defensive. But she loves her children anyway, and you know, it's a natural thing for her. But also, I think it's a little bit of rebelliousness against the prison. But the main thing we do for Candy in our volunteer group is find transportation for her little girl to get to school, because she's really hoping that her little girl can stay in this one school where she's so happy now. It's kind of a Montessori kind of school, and she thinks it's doing her little girl a lot of good, and she wants her to stay there. How many others do I have time to tell you about? Maybe two more. Sandy, Sam, she was one of the ones that I met first down there, and she's a very quiet and reserved girl, short hair and kind of athletic looking. I mean, she looks like she could run cross country, or she's not muscular or big or anything, but just kind of wiry. And she was in for armed robbery. She grew up in a farm in Faribault, and has a sister and has a very middle-class background, and has had high school education and everything. But she was terribly mixed up in her mind about who she was and how and everything, and so she did get in the drug scene, and she was convicted of armed robbery. Then she was convicted three more times. Each time, and this was for escape. Every time you escape, you've committed another felony, so you get prison term on top of prison term on top of prison term, and that was her case. But somehow or other, maybe she grew out of it or what, anyway, she finally figured herself out, and I think possibly with the help of some of our people in our group, and she got enrolled in college, and she has since graduated from college in sociology and is about to go in to get her PhD now. And she's brilliant. She's gotten about a 3-point grade point average all through college, and she was scared to start. She went in general college because that's easier, but she's done great. So she's kind of a success story. Bernice is an Indian who grew up in one reservation and then some bad city situation, and she remembers still at age 38 that a teacher told her, "You're nothing but an Indian. You know, you'll never be any good." And she remembers when she was 8 years old being told that. And sure enough, she has never been any good. She's also an alcoholic. Beautiful, gentle person, except when she's drunk. And boy, oh boy, she changes. And she gets very... I could tell you a real dramatic story about Bernice, but maybe I'll just sit around if you want to ask more after I can tell more, because to go into the whole story would take too long now. But Bernice is I think, one of the victims of the kind of way we've treated Indians. I can't help but think that about Bernice. Arlene was in for murder. She was actually she was about 30, 34, I think. Very fair complected woman with blue eyes and black hair. She could be beautiful, but she was too fat. She just had let herself go. But she was in a mental hospital, actually, for a nervous breakdown, and she got out of the hospital, and she was alone, and she had a lot of family problems, and she had two kids, and, you know, there's all kinds of things with Arlene's life, but she was alone in Minneapolis, and she got depressed again after getting out of the hospital. She was in a room in a hotel, a divey old hotel where poor people have to go, and it isn't very pleasant surroundings, and she really just got so depressed that she decided to commit suicide. And her personality is the kind, you know, that she decided to commit suicide by setting herself on fire. And so she did, and it started the hotel on fire. It didn't kill Arlene, but it killed some other people. So she's in prison for manslaughter. And she had been there 9 years, and the one that had been there the longest of any of the women I met. And really, she'd sit like this, and she just didn't think a thing of herself. You know, she'd maybe The only way she could speak at all was some kind of smart aleck remark, but a hostile remark. But mostly she just didn't say anything. But one of the women in our group, somehow or other, there was some kind of affinity between, they got to visiting and gossiping with each other and talking about their kids, and they get to meet friends, you know. This is a neighbor of mine. And she began taking Arlene out to her house, and she's kind of a strong-minded woman, this neighbor of mine. And the bureaucracy that faced Arlene was a challenge to Dorothy. And she just kind of plugged holes and punched holes in all this bureaucratic red tape that Arlene was suffering from and helped break water for her to get out into the community. And Arlene is okay now and is living in her own apartment and selling Shockley products. And also she, of course, is on welfare. But she's been, I've seen her several times and she seems to be doing okay. So she's another kind of success story. And she's lost weight and she looks beautiful. And she's joined Parents Without Partners and goes to dances now. And her personality's completely changed. So she's great. I don't have any proper closing for my thing. Just I figured that when I got time, I better quit. So I'm going to quit now. And I think it's almost coffee time, but I'll just sit here. If anybody has any questions that you want to ask me personally, I'll be glad to answer. Okay?
May I ask this question? To back up your magnificent work that you are doing, you and your friends, your neighbors, and all that, at what point does the church come in? Do they come in with a structured program for these individuals to bring the gospel to them?
Well, we haven't got any formal backing. I don't doing this out of a church. This was just Jim and me and some friends. And we started a thing. We had to incorporate because we did want to go get a buy a house, a kind of halfway house for the folks, and we needed to collect money for that. And so we incorporated as a nonprofit corporation. So we're just ourselves. And the church as such doesn't have really a whole lot to do with this, but individuals in church have helped. And so what we sometimes do will be go out and visit women's groups, because these are our sisters, and so we primarily go to women's groups and churches, and we'll give maybe a little talk or a little workshop. Sometimes the women will come through then with something, and they've donated a lot of clothes. We have a boutique, and we ask for stylish, good-looking clothes that are clean and in good repair to be given to the boutique. And then the women can go choose an outfit when they have to go out and get a job. They have to get a job for themselves before they're put on parole. And they are in competition with the whole wide world with three or four strikes against them. And not the least of which is they got nothing to wear for the job interview. So but the women of the church, many of them have done a good job picking up clothes and stylish clothes. The women have one group that we went there 2 years ago to this little church up north of Trinity Lutheran in some North Branch, is that George, that's me? Anyway, 2 years ago we went, and you know, often you go out and you never hear from them, and you think, well, so we entertained them. But others sometimes come through. And 2 years later, I get a little note from the head of their peace unit or whatever, and they say, we would like to do something for the women in Shakopee. So they they wrote me a letter and asked what could we do. And I wrote a letter back and said, here's some things you can do. So they sent $47. They said, it's very little, but it's all we can do, but we want to come down and visit. And they came down, and I got the most beautiful letter back of how much they had learned from the women in prison, and they were really thrilled. And they were asking about individual women. Did Elsie get her parole? Did so-and-so get to see her parents? And they suddenly had a different picture. No, that was nice. Well, so individual women's groups, and individuals out of the churches have been helpful, but the church as a whole, I haven't gotten any structured programming or anything. There are women that go down there and give them Bible study from churches, but they're not particularly in our group. However, when we wanted to buy this house, then I will put a proposal into the church headquarters, and the church headquarters, out of their social action budget or something, did contribute $3,000 to our down payment on this house. So the institutional church has given us that much.
Where is the house?
It's over in St. Paul.
Molly, when you started this, when the first night that you went to the prison, was this optional for the women? that you meet with them 2 hours?
The women don't have to come to ours.
Not even the first one. Well, how do they respond? Do most of them come?
No. They come depending on what's going to happen and depending on the situation in this prison. Sometimes the tensions get so big that nobody goes anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so we only have 4 or 5 women. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there'll be 20. When we have a band, and you know, we brought a buffet, a smorgasbord down one night, and you know, there'll be 25, maybe, or 30. Generally, it's maybe a dozen or so that'll come. But individually, they'll call us. They have our phone numbers, and often I'll get a phone call from one of the prisoners that now that they're allowed to make phone calls. They have a lot more privileges now under the superintendent that's there now than they used to, as far as making phone calls and, you know, writing letters and having visitations and stuff. So in that way, they have it a little better than they used to. But they'll phone and say, I need somebody, or I have to go get my son, or I need to go to the doctor, no staff available, can you take me Saturday or something? So individually, and some of these women who ask for these don't come to the meetings. They're just not the type that want to go to meetings, you know, but they have gotten acquainted with us. And so
it seems to me that instead of prisons, what we should really have are a lot of miniature clinics.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Yeah, wouldn't that be fine? If in Southwest Minneapolis, you know, if I were for some reason or other busted, that's the term when you're arrested for something, and I went to prison, I wouldn't turn into anybody else. I'd still be Molly Raymond. What would be different about me except that I happened to have gotten caught at whatever I was doing, and who knows why I did it. But I'm still Molly, and I still got the same look in my face, and I got gray hair still, and, you know, I'm still 56, and, you know, whatever. Well, nothing will change me, so I'm just the same person inside as I would be outside.
Well, we've had 2 college professors from our small Midwestern college get caught shoplifting.
Yeah, it can happen to any of us. Uh-huh. But it might not be mental illness. It might just be ordinary something else, some hurt that comes out. You call that mental illness. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know about the first case. I could never understand that unless he was just being a show-off.
Uh-huh.
But the second one had a very bad family situation
that
I think probably made him ill.
Yeah. Well, I get what I wanted to respond to you with was when you say, I say amen to having a clinic in every neighborhood. If I were picked up for whatever, well, if my youngest son had been drafted, I might have been picked up for some kind of activity down to the draft office. You know, I wouldn't let him take my son. You know, that might be a thing that would fit with my life, but somebody else's crime would fit with their life. Why couldn't I stay in Southwest Minneapolis where I could occasionally see George and Alan and David and Kathy? And maybe I'd have to be locked up for some reason or other. Maybe I was violent and would either do damage or something. Okay, but there are other women in Southwest Minneapolis that have committed crimes too. Maybe there wouldn't be so many. You know, might be only 2 or 3 in any one year. But why couldn't we have a little house in Southwest Minneapolis where if I had to be locked up, I could be locked up in that house right in my own neighborhood? And if I was mentally ill and that was the thing, I could get help. Or if it was money I needed, I could get help how do you go about with your skills getting a job? Or whatever, if I needed school. There'd be only 2 or 3 of me, or maybe 8 or 9 of us in a small little institution. Community corrections, that seems to me would be ideal.
Yeah. The irony is you could actually do it cheaper that way than the way it's being done now.
Oh, yeah, it costs as much to keep a woman in Shakopee as it would be to send one of my sons to Harvard per year.
It would actually save citizens money, I think.
Yeah, although we can't do it because of the economy, because it isn't all that true. Because of this cost-benefit analysis that is done on every kind of institution, it works out. It would be cheaper in the long run, but on the first balance sheet, it would look terribly expensive, because they budget these things by per bed unit cost, and to keep our people, a few of them in Pie House, I can't remember how much it was. Do you remember what it was that per bed?
Well, I think for any kind of institutional care, it's up somewhere around $40 to $50 a day per person.
Right.
That's what it costs by the time you figure the staff you have to have and the cost of the building.
That's right. So it isn't all that much, you know, it isn't a direct saving like that. It doesn't cost that much to keep them in Shakopee. It costs about $18 a day.
But it does cost to keep them in Shakopee as much as it would cost to assign one person full-time to each of the individuals and let that be the custody. You could pay one person's salary for every prisoner.
Funny thing is that there is almost a one-to-one ratio now. And yet they only have three counselors and one psychologist.
Where you save money is that the rehabilitation surely would be much, much greater.
Sure, sure.
And they where they're so miserable and they keep on returning.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other ways in which it might save, because you might be able to have a bigger variety of needs fulfilled than, you know, not everybody wants to learn to be a key punch operator, and that's about all they can learn to be in or food service in Shakopee. If they were out in the community, they could learn a lot of other things, and they could maybe get a paying job, and over the long haul, they'd maybe be off welfare or something, you know. But that isn't the reason we should do it. We should really do it because it is humane and it is right, and the present system is a failure, and, you know.
But people won't do it unless it's expedient, I'm afraid.
I don't know.
Realize the term rehabilitation also means bring something back the way it was.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not necessarily what we want to do with some of these people, you know.
No.
Rehabilitation is not what's needed, something else.
Well, I don't even like that word because it's pretty meaningless, actually, because you don't know what you're talking about when you say rehabilitate, and you don't know what you're talking about when you say were you successful in a program, because they have a program and then they judge the program by the recidivism rate. And recidivism is another word that's real meaningless. That even sounds meaningless. Rehabilitation sounds like it has some meaning behind it, but yeah, this doesn't. But you get, recidivism means kind of the proportion or the percentage of times they go back to prison, assuming that's a failure, if you go back to prison. Okay, so in a year, and they keep this by statistics, not people's names, you have recidivism rate. Well, did one woman go back 25 times, or did 25 women go back once, you know? It doesn't mean anything, these words. I don't even like to use them.
Can you tell us a little bit about that second book that you,
This Bridges Not Walls, this one?
Yeah.
That is just a textbook I picked up from a speech class. It's on communication, general in communication. And it talks about how do we talk to each other.
Oh.
And it's a good book. I like it. If some of the things Fritz was telling us about communicating, you know, talking to each other, are in here. I saw this in our library. I didn't read this one, but apparently this is written by a prisoner, and he's praising God, and it's a book of praise. Rejoice, you know. I don't know what it is, but it's a book written by a prisoner. Yeah, go to the public library and go to the section on criminals, not criminology so much, but look up crime and look up women in prison. And there's some real good books just on the shelves in most every library. But we don't often go to that section.
You said you had women commit alcohol. Do you have people that come in, drug addicts?
Come in where?
Into Shakopee. Do they come in?
People very seldom are convicted of drug addiction, and that get them in prison. But many of the people who are convicted of whatever crime there is in the book do have a drug problem. Frequently, they don't go to the drug treatment program because the drug aspect of their crime was never brought up in court, and they just assumed nobody knew they had a problem. Because in prison, they can't have drugs, you know, supposedly. And so, I don't know if I'm asking a question. A lot of the people have a drug problem, but that isn't, it's a bit irrelevant, because a lot of people have a drug problem and they're not in prison, you know. It's kind of like some people under the tensions of prison become drug addicts in prison because a lot of stuff is available in most prisons.
Well, when I heard of a girl that was peddling drugs.
Uh-huh.
She was put in there.
Put in prison for...
Put in Shakopee, I thought.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, that could very well be. Uh-huh. When you say peddling, you know, this drug, I don't know. I don't really want to get in the drug. I don't know enough about the drug problem, but I've heard it. Drug users and peddlers are pretty much the same group, you know. I mean, if you like brownies, you know, you make them and you hand them out to your friends, and someone else wants some, you say, hey, I know where you can get a good batch of brownies. Go over to Mabel, she makes them. And that's kind of the drug peddling thing until you get to the sort of the mafia, the criminal, the organized crime is where it's really being peddled. But, yeah, a lot of people have drug problems. A lot of people have alcohol problems. And all of these are social problems. And there's nothing that goes on the outside that doesn't go on in prison. It's just a little... It's like everything that you know of, that you've ever heard of, goes on in prison only under pressure cooker conditions. So everything is intensified. So if they've got a drug problem outside, they probably have a worse one inside.
We had a guy from Stillwater State Prison come a couple times to some classes up at our high school. And he said that it's easier to get drugs there than it is to get them on the outside.
Yeah, that could very well be. Sure. I've heard that too.
Mm-hmm. And he said he's had more money when he's in prison. They're not supposed to have money or anything.
Mm-hmm.
At times, like, he's had $7,000 in his room.
Mm-hmm.
Drug traffic and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody saw a television program I saw called The Glass House. Did anybody ever see that? That talked about that kind of thing, the society inside prison. It's really not that much different from the outside, but it's just magnified. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know that's true. There's no point in keeping them there, really. I'm sure that's true, and I've heard of things like that too, and I know. I'm not very close to Stillwater prison anymore. I used to go up there to talk with the Indians up there, but I haven't been up there for a long time, but I know that's true. That's true. I don't know how we can... The only way we can get rid of that is get rid of that kind of prison, you know. Thanks, everybody, for letting me share with you.